Welcome, everyone, and welcome to Talking Critic, where our motto is hate and not dance. I'm your host, Bob Mackey, and I could have had rubber bands. And this is the Talking Simpsons Patreon's chronological exploration of The Critic. Who else is here with me today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and this episode gets my highest rating, 7 out of 10.
Oh, are you a video game reviewer? No, the opposite of a video game reviewer. Who else is here?
This is the outdated, elitist, and sexist Michael Raparez.
And who else?
And I am Diana Goodman, and you're mine. I own you. No wire hangers.
Yay. And today's episode is A Little Deb Will Do Ya.
So which will it be? White, white?
Yes. Except for the gloves.
Filthy, filthy jokes.
I love that joke.
Today's episode aired on February 23rd, 1994. And as always, Henry will tell us what was in theaters this week in real life history.
Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book!
Oh boy, Bobby! Wesley Snipes runs the Harlem drug trade in Sugar Hill, and Luke Perry plays a real-life bull rider who was killed by a bull in 8 seconds.
Wow.
Yes.
I didn't know Luke Perry was allowed to be in movies.
He was.
It seemed inevitable.
There's a brief little time there.
You know what? I have to apologize to Sideshow Luke Perry. He did an ad for Talking Simpsons or cut a promo for us,
yes.
So I'm sorry. You have magnificent sideburns. You're a beautiful man.
Luke Perry is great. He was on Oz, and he did a good job on that show.
Yeah,
and
he's secretly a good actor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But 8 seconds was a biopic on a real-life bull rider who, guess what, was gored by a bull and killed in the ring.
Like
I just thought it was based on, like, there's a short story about a bull rider who, like, illegally ties his hand to the bull and then his arm gets ripped off.
Oh, damn. I didn't know about that.
No, in real life, 8 seconds is the time at which if you are a good bull rider, which means staying on the bull and not getting bucked off, if you do more than 8 seconds, you are doing a very good job. So he passes the 8 seconds on this one particular bull, falls off, and then is gored through the chest by the bull, and then his best friend then does 8 seconds in his honor the next year, and so that's what this is about. Meanwhile, yeah, Sugar Hill, a classic Wesley Snipes film about drugs. It's pretty cool.
But Henry, this episode has a quite interesting tale behind the scenes if you want to get into that. You sent me a great article, a great Grantland article. What's the name of that in case people want to read it?
So the article that's on Grantland, which is still around even though they shut it down over a year ago, is Hollywood Archaeology, the TV show Tonya Harding Kneecapped. And it is written by the writer of this episode, Nell Scovell. And it was published on the 20th anniversary of the airing of this episode in 2014 and the 20th anniversary of Tonya Harding versus Nancy Kerrigan in the 94 Winter Olympics, which was the 5th highest rated thing in television history to that point.
Wow. There,
because it was perfect in case you somehow don't know. Nancy Kerrigan was attacked during her qualifiers for the Winter Olympics in figure skating, and it turns out that it was done by the ex-husband of her competitor, Tonya Harding.
Jeff Galooly.
What a great name.
It overshadowed the entire event. It was a perfect tabloid story to make the world care about figure skating, in America anyway, which they really didn't before.
Nancy Kerrigan went on to become the Queen of Blades in StarCraft.
And oh my God! I never realized that. It's all an Nancy
Is that
Kerrigan
the reference? Okay, we need to shut things down. I'm going to have a stroke. I can't believe this, Michael. Why didn't you tell me this when I met you years ago?
I just made the connection myself. I hadn't even thought about it. Like, oh yeah, Queen of Blades. It's
Jesus.
Like ice skates.
But I take none of that lore seriously now. Throw it all away.
So that was airing on CBS. And the very same night was scheduled a new episode of The Critic, which was already struggling in the ratings, and the Winter Olympics popularity didn't do anything to help it. And so the article written by Nell Scovell goes into how she, at the time, was a very rare thing of a sitcom writer, especially an animated sitcom writer. She has the background, guess what? Oh, she went to Harvard, too. Another Harvard person.
Yeah, smarty pants.
I wonder if her Harvard pedigree got rid of the misogyny that would prevent a woman from being allowed in a writer's room. Like, no, she went to Harvard. It's fine. She actually graduated cum laude at Harvard, so she's a real smarty pants.
Wow.
And the episode is directed by a woman as well, another Harvard alum. And so she talks about how in the really great article you should just read for all the context, that just as the world is celebrating two women attacking each other, that she's like, on the other channel, is a sitcom made that it was written by a woman and directed by a woman, which had never happened in American animation history before. She points out like, well, on Hanna-Barbera, there were a couple scripts written by women, but never directed by them. So
yeah.
This is the first time ever to a woman writer and director on an animated television
prime time
thing. But could they fight while wearing leotards?
Unfortunately, no.
Then maybe people would watch.
Yeah. Well, I should mention that Nell Scovell, who wrote this episode, also wrote the episode of The Simpsons, One Fish, Two Fish, Blowfish, Bluefish, which is about the poison fugu fish, fugumi, as Homer would say.
And she would go on, like she did this episode before going to write for Murphy Brown with that wit and sparkle.
Yeah, and Laura McMullen is sort of the female equivalent of David Silverman in terms of TV animation. She would go on to be the lead animation director of Mission Hill, creating that look of that show. And you kids, and by kids I mean 20-year-olds, will know her a lot from directing episodes of The Last Airbender and Korra. And she's all over the place doing great stuff. Lauren McMullen, credited as L.H. McMullen, because just like J.K. Rowling, mm-hmm. she didn't want to be initially judged by being a woman. And that's kind of sad that she had to do that. But now she's proudly Lauren, and we're all happy for her.
Yeah, that is sad. And also, I found out that Nell Scovell wrote one of my favorite early episodes of Space Ghost Coast to Coast.
Really?
Urges, the one where Zorak has to mate but will die if he mates with a praying mantis.
There are so many parodies of that Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Star Trek thing and everything. My favorite one is Rocko's Modern Life, where Filbert has to go to the 70s island to mate.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, it's a very 90s thing, 70s references. Well, I want to talk about – we don't really talk about the couch gags in The Critic. Another uncomfortable reference to Doris being dead.
Mm.
And Doris Grau, the voice actor, would be dead in a few years.
Yes. The joke is she calls – him to say that she got mistaken for a corpse, which by the end of 96, she is dead. Like Doris Grau is dead.
Poor Doris.
From the things they joke about with her, which is constantly smoking.
The opening movie parody is one of the most overused movie parodies. The 2001 monolith. The Simpsons did it.
Mm-hmm. Simpsons did it.
So everyone was just doing 2001 parodies at this time. I don't know what was in the air, but I guess this was the time to do it in animation, so go for it. But it's just sort of I was like, okay, whatever.
Everybody was drinking the Pensacola.
That's right. A nice little pun inside that, snuck inside that that parody.
And this is a rather feminist episode. Definitely more things written from a woman's perspective that I feel than you saw in a normal Critic.
Feminist than Marty's First Date, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's more feminist, but it also has some of the most – I mean, one of the most disturbing moments in a cartoon I've ever seen. We'll get to.
That shocked me as a 12-year-old.
You compare this episode of Margot standing up for independence and also making fun of sexist dudes to the first two episodes, which both involve Jay being lied to his face by a woman who has no name. Compared to those, it's quite feminist.
Yes. So I guess we can start. Jay is taking his laundry to his parents' house like a college loser.
I love that joke about the eggs, and he's like, apartment. Yes, they're chickens.
Yeah, he calls Liz Smith,
right? There's an opening scene about how there's nothing to eat for breakfast. Is he going to his parents' house also to steal food too?
Yeah, he wants it for breakfast.
Yes.
But that eggs don't ripen line, I thought that was in this scene when he's like, my eggs.
That's later.
So we find out he came on the wrong day.
Jay, what a nice surprise.
Margot, I've told you 1,000 times, don't bring in the lawn gnome. Oh, it's you, Jay.
I had some important business to take care of.
I'm sorry, Master Jay. I did so want to scrub your dainties, but they somehow caught fire. Why do they burn so long?
Dear God, why did you come today? A photographer's coming, and I wanted everything to look pretty.
I'll have you know, Mother, my face has graced thousands of T-shirts.
We just can't sell them.
Yeah, put them in that landfill with the Alf merchandise.
You know, Al Jean and Mike Reiss did write for Elf, show creators. So
they even talk about in their X-Files episode where there's an Alf reference, like Alf is in the lineup of aliens of the X-Files Simpsons, that then the creator, executive producer of Alf, who has Alf's voice, called them and said like, Hey, you could have called me to do Alf, they said. And Reese's response was, that's why Alf's never been on the show again.
They're not Paul Fusco fans or Fusco fans.
Yeah, sound like they were the biggest fans of writing for Alf. They're not particularly proud of
that. I have to throw in as a reference, it never quite hit me until watching this episode that their butler is just John Gielgud from Arthur.
The original
Dudley Moore Arthur. That's it, totally the voice he's doing, and he's sort of designed to look like him.
I do love that butler.
I had no idea.
An underrated jokester.
Did
he light them on fire, or did they spontaneously combust?
I think he lit them on fire.
Yeah.
And that he has to find a very long stick to hold them away from him. And the look on Jay's face when he's looking at the stick, he's rather embarrassed. And I have another The Simpsons Did It joke, but actually this is the other way around of The Simpsons ripping off a joke on this show. When Jay goes over to Franklin and asks about the news, and Franklin doesn't mention that the newspaper headline is "It's War" and then just talks about nothing else. So in the season 10 episode, Homer to the Max, where they're looking up in the newspaper that local man has same name as the Homer Simpson on TV. The newspaper says "It's War" on the cover. It's the same joke of a new going off and "It's War." So,
but I do love that big type over here, little type over here,
and then he just wants to smack Jay in the face. He's just like, "What bug?"
Yeah, why do they burn so long? Yes. Yeah, so Eleanor, I guess Margot, she wants Margot to be a debutante, and to explain it to the family, she shows off a video. This is kind of a long clip, but I did cut some stuff out.
The year is 1953, and what a year it's been. Audrey Hepburn won an Academy Award for Best Actress, and Fritz Zernike won a Nobel Prize in Physics. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg got the electric chair, but even more shocking were the new fashions from the House of Dior. Lovely. And speaking of lovely, Eleanor Wigglesworth came out at New York's Grand Debutante Ball. Not only is Eleanor lovely to look at, her dance partners say she's delightful to hold.
I had many partners then, including a young swain named Bob Fosse.
That's all visual, so I cut it out. But
that Bob Fosse joke isn't much. It's just like, and it's Bob Fosse who does his jazz hands dance.
Yeah, it's nice animation.
It's great animation. It's, the point, it's so inappropriate for a debutante ball to be doing, angular jazz dancing.
Yeah, that's true.
And sensual dancing.
The video ends with Eleanor passed out and giving out another Maurice LaMarche famous burp that puts out the candles or makes them flame up. I forget what happens.
It flames out into going out.
Okay.
And, just so for history's sake, Audrey Hepburn won for Roman Holiday in 1953. Fritz's Nobel Prize was, quote, for his demonstration of the phase contrast method, especially for his invention of the phase contrast microscope. And the Rosenbergs were executed for selling nuclear secrets to Russia, which their kids are trying to prove they didn't really do that, but it's a little murky.
He might have. She probably didn't.
Mm. Yeah. But they're both dead.
But there's a great J. Edgar Hoover joke, and the narrator innocently believes that he's on his way to a costume ball as Edgar Hoover is fleeing away, obviously embarrassed about being dressed in women's clothing. And I guess it's a Jay's Uncle Edgar.
I love that joke, though. This was something – Cracked had an article, and if it was on Cracked, it must be true, but that the women's clothing thing was made up by his enemies, that it wasn't true.
Okay.
It was just a homophobic attack on him, which there are lots of reasons to hate J. Edgar Hoover. And so I was just saying he wears women's underwear. That is the least horrible thing about him if he did that. How about search J. Edgar Hoover, Martin Luther King?
Oh, maybe. Boy. Yeah.
You might know about some of his feelings on that. But so I do like that he was related to Edgar Hoover. That's great. And the Bob Fosse thing, the other thing I want to mention was, as a kid, I thought this joke also worked because Bob Fosse was clearly gay. Duh, he's gay. He was not.
What?
Not at all. Huge womanizer. The stories about him were just because he was surrounded by gay men in his profession, he had his choosing of women in that. He was quite a philanderer.
Wow, I didn't know that. So up next, we have Eleanor extolling the virtues of the debutante ball. And we also learned her name was Wigglesworth in that last clip,
which
is interesting.
That's a perfect maiden name for her. I love that. Yep.
That debutante ball is a Wigglesworth tradition. To starve yourself to fit into a dress, to dance with boys who feel you up, to drink so much you fall into a well. It's a magical night.
Mother, I am not going to be a debutante, and you can't make me.
You have no choice. I will not be defied. You're mine. I own you. No more wire hangers. Oh, perhaps I overdid it. Jay, you talk to her. You'll change her mind.
But what if I don't?
Then get her to take a bite of this apple.
So Jay's mom is a witch, in case you couldn't tell.
She literally becomes the evil queen from Snow White by the end of that scene.
Yeah, we get a Mommy Dearest and a Snow White reference. Obviously, the story of Joan Crawford, Mommy Dearest. And I'm sure you heard the podcast, You Must Remember This, did it like a 9,000-part series on Joan Crawford. Have you heard that, Diana?
It's good. And it was so great.
I've never felt such pity for such a mean woman. But she earned the right to be mean. That's what I think is great about her.
Mommy Dearest is... Well, it makes her look quite horrible, that's for sure. And that Faye Dunaway does a very good job of playing her.
She does an amazing job. Yeah. It probably tanked Faye Dunaway's career because she's so freaking scary and terrifying.
I mean, they didn't know they were making Camp, though, right?
No, they thought it was a very, very serious film. Mm. This is the Oscar-winning quality film, and it is hilariously stupid.
And what do wire hangers do? I forget.
She just preferred the other type of hangers.
You treat these dresses like they're trash!
Yes.
That's why. She just – everything, it has to be only the finest. She's a neat freak. She's freaking out. Mm. That's the most famous scene where she finds a wire hanger, somehow got into the house, and she beats a little kid with it.
Well, also, if you've ever lived with someone with a narcissistic personality disorder, it's just about rules. It's not about them making sense.
Yeah.
It's
not about logic at all.
No.
And Jay is trying to calm down Eleanor. It's like, oh, she's inherited your will. And the great line, she may have my will, but she doesn't have my gun.
Like Bart Simpson, Margot also has a treehouse, which she goes to multiple times.
But I have a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Do we know how old Margot is?
She's 16.
16.
So she's going to be drinking at her debutante ball.
In Eleanor's imagination, that's what you're supposed to do, yes. Though
because that is what Eleanor did.
Yeah.
Right. Was the drinking age lower in the 50s, though? I think it might have been.
I think it's just different rich people rules.
Yeah. I mean, in the 70s, they had like near beer. And I think in the 70s, they did raise the drinking age to 18, right? I don't know.
And I think it's pretty good animation on Jay getting pecked in the butt. That was good.
We have one line, and this ties into the Talking Simpsons. I think this is a reference to Klaus von Bülow.
Oh, 100%.
So take some of those pills you got from Dr. von Bülow. Is Jay just saying, like, I want you to die?
No, she's in a coma.
Okay.
So he can just run around with her money without having to deal with it.
I see.
So Klaus and Sonny von Bülow were a couple where she had all the money and he actually didn't, and they were highfalutin society people. And suddenly she fell into a coma, and they're like, well, how did this happen? It seemed like she was hypoglycemic and got injected, which means she has too much insulin already and seems to have gotten injected with more of it, and it put her in a coma while her husband's philandering and running around and generally being just kind of a creepy, weird dude. And so they, I think, tried to charge him with attempted murder, but it looked like, well, maybe someone else is trying to frame him.
Yeah, and he was played by Jeremy Zion in the movie, what was it called again?
Reversal of Fortune.
Okay, I did all this research. I forgot that she was in a coma.
We just talked about this on Boy Who Knew Too Much episode of Talking Simpsons.
Yeah.
What was the final take from this, Diana? I couldn't tell. Is it like an OJ thing? Well, of course he did it. Or is it more nebulous, like no one can really know? Like, I don't know.
It seems pretty likely he did it, but it also is one of those, it's kind of, a lot like OJ, where it's like, well, someone might be trying to frame a guilty man, so maybe, Reversal of Fortune with Jeremy Irons, which is totally his, like, breakout role.
Yeah.
It's really good, and it's really just about the legal case, but goes back into what their life is like. All the different scenarios that could have caused this, but the idea is this is Dr. von Bülow giving someone pills. He's like, oh, you're a rich woman? This is going to fuck you up.
We did the trailer on Talking Simpsons. I'm repeating myself in a way, but I thought it was amazing that his legal team for his retrial was Alan Dershowitz, Elliot Spitzer, and the Mad Money guy, Jim Cramer. Those two were Harvard law students at the time.
No way. Yay!
And now Elliot Spitzer is a famous John, so that's what he did with his life.
Well, I think the joke is also kind of making a reference to Eleanor's apparently superhuman constitution.
Yes.
Like she can boil her face for 2 hours. She needs to take coma pills just to calm down.
Yes.
And as Nell Scoville, and she revealed in her article the line of, what are you doing with that? It's called parenting. That was a Judd Apatow line.
Yeah.
She says that Judd Apatow came up with that one, who was one of the staff writers on the first
season. While lying on a couch, apparently. Just sat up to deliver the line and laid back down.
The magic of Apatow.
What are you doing with that gun? Put your head up. Parenting. Lay back down.
That was when Judd Apatow could still be pithy and not have, you know, scenes stretch out into interminable improv.
3 hour long movies. So this is 40. What a piece. I loved Franklin having the two glasses in his hand, and he doesn't even care that he had a glass shot out of his hand.
Not to worry.
Just pulls out another one.
So Margot and Jay have a heart to heart about debutante balls.
Debutante balls are outdated, elitist, and sexist. You said so yourself in your review of Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, it was really off on a tangent that day.
Can't you help me? Please talk to Mom.
All right. I do have a way with women. Over 60.
So Eleanor has the gun, and we find out what she's going to do with it next.
Margot, if you don't go to the debutante ball, I'm going to do the rudest thing I've ever done.
Rude.
I'm going to shoot your horse.
You wouldn't.
Just watch me.
But going to the ball means violating everything I stand for.
And you think I like shooting animals?
I'm begging you, don't.
On the count of four.
Stop.
One.
Jay, do something.
Two.
Should I jump on the horse and ride it away?
It'd be less cruel to shoot it. Three.
Wait.
Four.
Okay. I'll go.
Oh, darling. Now, I hope you're not just doing this for me.
What a contemptible person.
It seems so plausible that she is going to shoot this fucking horse.
Yeah.
It's hardly the first horse she shot, I would bet. This is my biggest problem with this episode is that Eleanor should have learned a lesson, or she should have apologized for this. Like, she gets what she wants, and that's it. Like, and she's happy by the end. She doesn't learn a lesson. This is just pure cruelty.
She just wants control.
This is something Margot will be telling her therapist about for the rest of her life.
So she just wants to send her to this debutante ball, which – these are very much still a thing.
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Usually, I mean, they're a charity-type event, which they'll get into once we get to the debutante ball. But, yeah, the idea that a fun lady of a certain age should dress up basically in a wedding dress and be presented to society.
As an object.
I have another story related to this, though, that once I was doing a corporate event in a large hotel down in Texas, and I see all these girls walking around in wedding dresses, and I'm like, is there like a photo shoot or something? Find out, oh no, junior league debutante ball tonight.
Oh, I mean, oh god.
I'm like, what? Okay, yeah, that's a thing, sure. The part that made it hilarious to me, though, is I go to get dinner at the hotel bar, and some of their boyfriends are hanging out, like, drinking beer. Like, oh yeah, no, you know, Caitlin's working, she's doing her thing, whatever, we're gonna hang out later. And it's like, Hussy White.
Hussy White, yeah. I mean, I think only purity balls have one updated in creepiness where, of course, you pledge your virginity to your father as a young woman, as all young women do. And you wear a ring that says, Daddy, I will not have sex with anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just a very normal thing, and I'm sure none of those fathers will be arrested at some point for anything.
Of course not,
I'm sure you're not, I don't know, warping a woman's idea of her body or what she can do with
it.
Just imagine a gender swapped version. My sexuality belongs to my mother. creeped myself the fuck out.
I'm not my own person anymore.
Well, that is Buster and Lucille Bluth, the mother boy.
That's true.
I didn't think of that.
Which Lucille Bluth and Eleanor have a lot in common. The one is the California wasp and the other is the New England wasp. But two different strains of the same deadly insect.
The Critic will be right back, you TV-addicted couch monkeys.
Get your VCRs ready for The Critic, because once is not enough. It's so funny, you've got to tape it and watch it again. He's the man who hates everything.
stink.
In the first new animated show from the people who brought you The Simpsons, watch and tape The Critic.
So this is a show in the mid-90s, of course, and you can't have a mid-90s show without making fun of Barney the Dinosaur. And I was going to get a clip, but I'm like, you have to know who Barney is. Like, Barney has just been unavoidable even now. So, and I feel like Henry and I are old enough that we just dodged the Barney bullet. We are just old enough to not be in Barney's audience. But he started in, like, 1991, I think.
Mm-hmm. I definitely would watch him every now and then, but I knew I was too old for it. But I want to say this to some of the listeners. We made fun of Barney on the Burns' Bear episode. In Rosebud, we make fun of Barney because there's a Barney joke in there too. And people are like, at least one person said, oh, you guys are so above Barney. It's for kids. I was like, I want to re-say this again. We are mocking Barney as being bad for children. It is a bad show for children to watch because it is so empty and brainless. They aren't learning anything.
Why were they mad we were agreeing with the show? I don't get it.
Well, they thought we were judging it as like, this show's not for me. It's like, no. Sesame Street is judge Sesame Street is a way better show for children that isn't technically for me.
That's why the Simpsons joke with 2 + 2 = 4, 2 + 2 is just artless and dull and just like, it's not creative in any way. But
Humphrey is at least a little more creative.
Yeah, for some reason, Humphrey is Jay's competition. I don't get how that works at all.
Yeah,
but Duke,
where are they scheduling
yeah, it's
shows?
Like 7 a.m. is coming attractions, but Duke explains it in some way.
Yeah, he has a good explanation.
Kids love that guy.
So? Kids don't watch my show.
Well, they did. Their testing showed you reminded them of the Pillsbury Doughboy.
Don't! I find that so demeaning. Hey, look! The Doughboy and I happen to be ticklish in the same spot, but that doesn't give you the right to...
Son, from now on, we fight fire with fire. I want you to be my hippo.
Look, I'm flattered, but... Kidding.
Dance for me, Jay. Dance!
I don't have to dance.
Yes, you do. It's in your contract.
I believe the contract I signed called for me to prance.
You win this round, Sherman.
Just like with Grandpa Simpson, tickling Jay Sherman is a form of abuse.
Yeah, that's true. And then Homer would be mistaken for Poppin' Fresh in season 7 in the bowling episode or bowling episode.
My bowling. And I didn't get this Merchant Ivory parody, but it's the movie is the Tea Cozy. I mean, I didn't get the clip, but I know it's making fun of. Diana, please.
The Tea Cozy about, oh, my warm tea cozy and you will love to see. It's actually Howard's End. And they even say it's from the people who made Howard's End. Howard's End, though, is a house, not a tea cozy. But, I mean, it's so specific that, you know, the dying woman is supposed to be like Vanessa Redgrave and that. And here, my tea cozy. And then the guy says, oh, it's just a tea cozy. And he gets slapped. And then a bookcase falls on him. That happens in Howard's End.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't see Howard End.
Yeah,
I mean,
a guy gets crushed by a bookcase.
Howard ends?
Yes, that's how Howard ends.
Just a bloody tea cozy.
These kind of very proper, very, I guess, erudite movies were very good joke fodder in the 90s. Mm. I mean, Seinfeld made fun of the English Patient famously in the episode The English Patient.
Well, Merchant Ivory was much more – it was even more specific than English Patient. It was just such a very – it's a very dour period piece made by two gay dudes in England. Yep. And so – It was also seen as like briefly as the Oscar fodder of just like wins
they're
award.
Always their quality. They're based on on fancy pants novels that you probably haven't read, but they're very well regarded. You know, your Remains of the Day or your
is the piano one of them?
No,
okay,
no, it's not. But it's kind of in that style.
Same,
the piano's
yes.
like a sexy version of sort of thing.
With male frontal nudity, even.
But, yay. Hi, Harvey Keitel. But yeah, Room with
Good
a View.
Good Lieutenant.
Yeah, Room with a View, that sort of thing. Everyone is really stuffy, proper. It's based on a novel. The acting is all really good. The costumes are gorgeous. It's really pretty to look at. Rewatchability? Question mark.
Mm. Well, I remember reading the story that when Quentin Tarantino won the Palme d'Or for Pulp Fiction, he said, like, I'm glad you gave this to me instead of some of that boring Merchant Ivory shit. Like, we need some exciting films now, not that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, which he got some booze for that.
Apples and oranges, man.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, they're for different audiences.
Yeah.
Well, and then, of course, there were so many wannabe Merchant Ivory films, but not half as many as there were wannabe Tarantino films after Pulp Fiction. It's unbearable how many of those there were.
God,
even the good ones were like, no.
Still remember my favorite review of, was it Eight Heads in a Duffel Bag? Oh. And saying, like, I sure hope one of those heads is Quentin Tarantino's because this movie is his fault.
Well, here's Jay's review of the tea cozy.
What the devil is a tea cozy? And why aren't you prancing?
Don't worry, I have a big joke coming up. So run, don't mosey to the tea cozy. It really hits the spot.
Where's the joke? So we're on the air. I know we're on the air, but where's the joke?
It was really more of a bon mot.
I think they were making fun of Gene Shalit here.
I love the desperation in Duke's voice. Where's the joke?
Yes. I know we're on the air, but where's the joke?
He's not being mean to Jay. He's just consternated. He's just like, no, where is it?
You said there was a joke.
Yes, and that was a very Gene Shalit type line, definitely, who had been on the show twice by this point.
Up next, Margot being fitted for her dress by a super gay tailor. I like when he swallows the pin.
Really?
That's going to be a fun journey. The pin going through his bowels and
that
out of his
was
ass.
Funny.
But we get one of the dirtiest jokes on the critic that you heard up front. Let's hear the whole thing in context.
Now, Mama, I need to speak with my client alone, so get out. Go on, shoo. Here's the skinny. We dressmakers have a very strict code, so I need to know, do you deserve to wear virginal white? Because if you don't, you'll have to wear an off-white, what we call a hussy white. So which will it be? White white?
Yes. Except for the gloves.
Oh. Too bad the Married with Children audience isn't there. They would have really enjoyed that joke. Of course, she's given a hand job before.
All right. So, yeah, I did kind of read this like it could also mean she's touched herself, that maybe that's how she views it. But I like it more that she's given a hand job to somebody.
She's touched one.
I think they want to make it so she's touched a penis.
Yeah.
Or at least someone's genitals. Hey, let's not assume.
That's true.
Well, no, she's only been attracted to guys on the show and definitely is attracted to dudes. But, yeah, I it's such a great joke that they got in there of just that I feel – I don't know. That feels like a Nell Scovell thing of something that a woman writer would have done of just admitting like, yeah, a 16-year-old girl – might have given a hand job at some point.
So up next we have Jay confronting Humphrey. I forget where it happens. Is it a video store?
So it's outside the video store, which first off, at the video store, there is actually a poster for Spike Lee's F. It's right there. It's a nice callback to a reference already did. And then it's a reference I didn't get until I went to the video store. Berlin Alexanderplatz, which was famous as like the longest movie ever. But it's as I would find out when I worked at a mom and pop video store in 2007 and I was finally at a place that had that movie. It's when I realized like, well, it's the longest movie ever because it's a mini series that was on TV sketched into a film. So that's like saying Game of Thrones is the longest movie ever. Like this Sopranos is the longest movie ever. So you're just not watching it the way you're supposed to. But that's how it was then. When were people going to watch a West German mini series other than in a theater in America? So
I love the idea. That's his idea of just, you know, a relaxing night at home. Let's watch 13 hours of Berlin Alexander.
That's Jay Sherman.
And that they'd done it before. Marty was like, again.
not a great time with Marty. And also, I think this is the first NWA reference I've seen on TV. Humphrey's video, Hug the Police, obviously reference to the song Fuck the Police by NWA, and that stands for Naughty People with Attitudes. Look up – I'm not going to say it on the air. It means something else. But here's Jay confronting Humphrey, who he hates.
Would you like to dance with me?
No, I would not like to dance. You are an insipid walking commercial, and your cereal turned my urine pink.
Well, you have to eat 6 bowls for that to happen.
Yes, yes, and a gallon of chocolate milk. But that's not the point. I think America's children are our future, not the opportunity to make a quick buck. You should be ashamed.
He made Humphrey sad. Break his thumbs!
Let's get out of here, son.
Oh, this is worse than the time you sucker punched Mr. Rogers.
That's a mean joke.
Yeah, Mr. Rogers is the nicest man alive. What did he do to Jay to make him do that?
Mr. Rogers is a saint.
Yes.
It's just a good shock joke. I mean, and I like to imagine the one saying break his thumbs is Babs Bunny because it's basically the same.
Wait, Diana, Fred Rogers, Philadelphia Institution, correct?
Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh, okay.
Pittsburgh.
Got the wrong P-town.
One of those other part of the state.
More steel, less brotherhood.
And then we meet a real blue blood, which I just love that Eleanor finds a date for Margo.
Reeve Winthrop the 14th. And obviously just a horribly inbred aristocrat. But Margo tests him to find out how inbred he is.
Tell me, Reeve, what's 7 times 8?
13?
Sharp as a tack.
As I suspected, all that inbreeding has rendered him an idiot. I said I'd go, but if I do, I'm going with Jay.
Well, I think Reeve's adorable, and if you won't go to the ball with him, I will.
What about me?
I was just going to give you some rubber bands to play with, but if you want to, you can come.
Oh, I could have had rubber bands.
Okay, as much as I like the hand job reference, this is my line of the show. Can I play line of the show? Okay.
I just made that up.
I just love how easily amused Franklin is. She was going to have rubber bands to play with, and how crestfallen. He's like, I could have had rubber bands.
I think the obvious connection between Franklin and Reed, that they are the same guy, just 50 years apart, I think that also shows you what Franklin's mental issues are somewhat from. I think the same level of inbreeding has led to him being that stupid.
You know what?
Does he have actual blue blood and he can only get get transfusions from George Will and Mrs. Walter Cronkite?
I thought it was George Plimpton.
It is George Plimpton.
Sorry, George Plimpton.
But I don't get that Mrs. Walter Cronkite thing. I looked up. Sure, she was not – she wasn't like famously an aristocrat or anything, so I don't really get that joke. Call in and tell us or comment on this and explain that joke to me.
Diana is right. I think part of Franklin's problem is he is inbred, an inbred aristocrat. That's a sharp as a tack. I love Franklin Sherman.
And then we get another reference to something old, and when Margot is asking Jay to be her date on the phone, that – he's bringing up the musician Skip Martin and Skip Martin's band, who was a jazz musician and had been dead since 1976. But I'd never even heard of Skip Martin before.
So he won't be playing the Rainbow Room?
Yes. That Ethel character, I like when they bring back the Ethel joke and Margot just tells him, like, don't bring Ethel.
Yes.
Just like that he has obvious mental problems talking to Ethel all the time. Every person has a mental illness on this show.
Yeah.
Except for Margot.
And this never seen again Irish maid pushes Jay down the stairs in a girdle. That's outside of his clothes. Yes. You should know that shouldn't be happening.
I love that joke of the deed is done. I've said that a million times, cleaning up my apartment and then like or finishing some housekeeping task and then just going, oh, the deed is done. And that he falls on Mittens for a second time, which the unseen Mittens the cat that lives in their house.
I forgot to mention, speaking of animals, when Jay talks about jumping on the horse and riding away, and that will obviously kill the horse, I think it's a reference to when he killed Patches as a boy, jumping on a pony.
Oh, yeah.
Patches.
Well, Jay is a horse killer.
The girdle scene also, I kind of appreciate because it is a weird joke. It sort of comes out of nowhere and goes nowhere. But I think it's just like, this is such a cliche.
Yeah.
The girdle tightening scene. In any movie where there's anything with like fancy dress.
And the Irish maid, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And you definitely assume it's being done to Margot and then you see
exactly.
That it's Jay.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a good
joke.
So
it's a subversion of a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
So the debutante ball is happening at the Museum of Natural History, who takes the fun out of Jurassic Park. And this is where Jay meets the woman who will later find out plays Humphrey the Hippo.
Excuse me, may I have your autograph?
Oh, for the third time tonight, I'm not Roger Ebert.
I know. You're Jay Sherman, and you're much cuter than Roger Ebert.
Wow. Cuter than Roger Ebert?
We're doing, like, a Roger Ebert joke on every episode now.
Yeah. Yep. Remember Burns made that noise when he said, you don't have to sue me to get my pants off? Same. They love it.
Isn't that like Conan O'Brien's noise?
It really is. He made that noise.
Yeah. I think they got that from Conan in the writing room.
Yeah. And also, there was a James Coco joke, which is just that he's a fat farting dude who, again, had been dead since 1987.
James Coco went mad in minutes.
Yeah, see, there was a James Coco joke not months earlier in Trias of Horror 4.
It would have been Brando if he was dead.
Mm-hmm, but
he's the better known corpulent actor guy.
Though this is the Simpsons joke was a little meaner because that joke was, this man is dead, he was fat, and he's in hell.
And he stunk up a limo once after eating chili.
Yes, yeah. But that American History Museum looks so awesome.
It's really good.
I've got to go there the next time I'm in Manhattan.
Lauren McMullen is an animation superstar, and you can really see on this episode with all like the dance numbers and just the beautiful staging and everything like that.
I noticed something weird. I might be wrong about this, but like when Jay's face is kind of close to that woman who plays Humphrey – Her face is like the shape of the negative space outside of his face. Oh. It's like they almost fit together like puzzle pieces.
That's excellent. I didn't notice that, but you can credit Lauren McMullen with that, just that great staging that you – it's really subtle.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a theory of mine, but the unnamed woman who plays Humphrey, she is not going to name like a lot of women on the show, but I feel that her design was intentionally given more masculine features to lead you to assume that the joke later of the crying game joke later is set up for it.
You know what? You're right. I noticed that she had like thicker eyebrows and like a larger chin.
She's taller than most of the men around there. Mm. And so I think it was – I don't think she's a poorly designed person or unattractive, but I do feel like – I think she was intentionally designed for the crying game joke
in a deeper voice. But it's like they don't really justify that kind of crappy joke. And it's not like it's not built up enough to be funny. Like they don't add in the mysteries. There's like one line referencing it and then it's immediately revealed that she's a woman.
Crying game references are just funny, Bob. It's funny. This person has different genitals than you expected.
That's hilarious.
Hey, that's not where anyone thought that movie was going to go.
That was true.
The last time everyone kept a secret. There were no spoilers. Everyone was like, what's the spoiler? And you're like, dude, you should go see it because that's not what – the movie's not about that at all. It's about fucking IRA guys on the run.
I realize now.
Oh, shit, that guy's girlfriend. Still his girlfriend, but doesn't have the parts he thought.
That's why the joke at the very end of the episode is him asking them people not to spoil the end of it because of Crying Game. But let's skip to that.
Man, what a great movie.
But I liked Margot getting one over on those guys who were kind of drawn – they are definitely Beavis and Butthead of the critic world.
They're not aristocrats like, oh, it's a skank patrol or whatever. Just like, why are they here?
But she gets an okay knock on them. And then that nitro-burning funny cars line, I like that, but it's so second take, but I
vroom,
love it.
Vroom,
vroom. Vroom, vroom.
And so this woman meets Jay under the blue will, and she'll know it's him because he's wearing a carnation. And the debutantes are singing "I Think I'm Going Out of My Head" to benefit people suffering from massive head injuries. Let's hear a bit of the original song.
Well, I think I'm going out of my head. Yes, I think.
Male singer, by the way.
Yes.
very good voice, though. Yeah, and it's another of the many Al Jean and Mike Reese jokes you saw in The Simpsons where it's the most inappropriate song that could be playing at any given time, like Baby Come Back when Maggie is missing, Everyone Needs a Clown when Krusty is trying to kill Homer, Everybody Loves a Clown, sorry. Mm.
And this one is they're singing that song for people who have had massive head injuries.
I like how they're just shut into a room with the lights off.
The head injury fun room, I think it's called.
Yeah. Well, again, it's about debutante balls are supposed – they're basically a charity fundraiser is supposed to be the idea. You're raising funds for charity. But yeah, the point is no, they're freaking not. It's just a dumb party where everyone gets dressed up fancy and tries to impress each other with how fancy they are.
I don't know much about debutante balls, but I don't think the real things involve like coordinated musical numbers between all the debutantes.
No, but you do.
There is a point where you come out and you have to – curtsy to the entire audience.
You come down a giant set of stairs, correct? You have to.
Sure.
You should.
I think the going out of my head scene is one of the best animated portions of The Critic ever. Like, it's so well-timed. It has seven distinct models of debutante doing their performance.
I mean, there's no real joke outside of the song they're singing, and it goes on a little long, but it's just really pretty to look at.
Well, they let Jay sing part of it too. Of course, they cannot resist letting John Lovett sing.
I love when he sings. He's got a beautiful voice.
And
but
the real-life blue whale exhibit that is in the American Museum of Natural History is so gorgeously set up in that shot. It's beautiful. And it's the same place where if you've seen the movie The Squid in the Whale. The Squid in the Whale diorama is also there.
Of
the giant squid fighting the whale, which in the film Squid in the Whale represented a bitter divorce.
I've never been. So let's hear a little bit of Jay romancing another unnamed suitor or sutress maybe in The Critic.
I want you to want me. I need you so badly. I can't think of anything but you.
You know the sound whales make when they're in love?
And Eleanor is looking on and saying, I hope she at least sleep with him before she kills him.
That's great. That she just accepts like, definitely an attractive woman would never want to be with Jay, so mm-hmm. it must be to murder him. And that
to be fair, there's some precedent there.
Yes, yeah. But okay, so thematically, this is what I think is the weakest part of the episode.
Yeah, it falls apart in the third act.
That she stands up for herself, but it's a very kind of like empty Lisa Simpson speech against debutante balls, which – and it doesn't really lead to anything. She's just kind of sad, and Jay's like, hey, good speech. And then Eleanor doesn't learn a lesson. Like,
yeah.
She's just like, yeah, okay, well, I forced you to do something, and you did it. The end. Like,
let's hear Margot's speech.
This whole evening makes me sick. It's just a tasteless contest to see who can waste the most money. People are starving outside while you sit here stuffing your faces. The money we spend here tonight could keep this museum open on weekends.
Betty, Veronica, take her out.
Giant security guards in dresses show up.
Yeah, Betty and Veronica, Archie's girlfriends.
I think they lost an opportunity to actually have a feminist message because none of her points are really dealing with feminism that much. It's more about like waste and capitalism.
It's not about how women are being treated there.
Yeah, it's strange how they lose that moment when that's what the episode is building up to. I was a little let down by this and how it doesn't really resolve in anything.
Not really. And then when you couple it with a few minutes later, she's sad she didn't get a dance, which just also really undercuts her feelings on not wanting to. She's like, and none of those guys even danced with me, revealing that, like, see, she may complain, but she did want to dance from a cute boy.
No, you see, it's a two-pronged joke that I totally relate to as a teenager. That it was like, not even any of those stupid stuck-up jerk boys wanted to dance with me. It's like, they're stuck-up stupid jerks. But I also wish that they would pay attention to me, but I know that they're stupid, stuck-up jerks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. That's true.
I don't want to go to your fun party for assholes who are enjoying life.
Yeah.
But if I have to, I at least want to have some fun while I'm here.
Yeah. And she gets something nice. She gets to dance with that guy. I liked his reveal
the
of like
– limo driver bartender.
I feel like the joke would have been in something else like, I'm also a superhero or I'm also a spy. Like,
I'm also a famous actor researching a role.
But instead, it's just very low stakes of like, I'm also a bartender. Like, that's
Two jobs. So we cut back to – I think it's the Humphrey Ladies apartment. And we hear about a terrible secret that Jay is excited about.
It's really great how excited he is.
Yes. Yes.
Yes!
Oh, Jay.
You have such beautiful eyes.
Yes, Jay. But there's a terrible secret that awaits you below my waist.
Ooh, a terrible secret.
Okay, let's just have a look-see.
Machi Machi, you're Humphrey the Hippo.
That's my name. Don't wear it out.
But seriously, Jay, I've been attracted to you since I saw you in the video store.
Oh, my God. I can't believe I'm going to make love with the thing I have the most contempt for in the world.
We are going to make love, aren't we?
Oh, Lord. Lisa, yes.
Jay sucks.
He's so sad.
I mean, this is funny stuff, but I think they should have just cut out this Humphrey stuff and develop the Margot story more. I mean, it was all leading up to a cheap crying game joke. You're right, Henry. It's not even communicated that well where you had to point that out to me when I was like, oh, I guess it is a crying game.
Well, it is also like, so this is a show that tries to – this episode tries to have this feminist message, but at the same time, like, Humphrey the Hippo falls for a man who comes into where she's working and insults her.
Yeah. It's not explained why she likes Jay either. It's just there to be very convenient. And
it's like not like you came in and like showed me the error of my ways. I'm going to try to be more educational from now on something. I don't know.
We have no idea how she feels about this character.
Yeah.
I don't know. I doubt she writes her material or whatever. This might just be a job. She tried to get work. She couldn't get work.
Yeah, I mean, they could have developed that more. I mean, we have to guess, but it's funny how she isn't really mad. It doesn't really concern her that Jay was so bad in bed. She's just very like we learned him miserable. He lasts about a minute in bed. So
and I love that she can admit he's like, wow, he's so secure when he's so terrible in bed.
Yeah,
and just that's hilarious. And but yeah, just that music, hearing it audio even more so, hearing that music there is like, this is all crying game. Like, this is so crying game of setting up like, oh, she's really a man. So from the design too, I feel like you're supposed to get that. And I just hate that quote, they're really a man thing is just like, ugh, it's all aged
so
poorly.
The whole, like, trap thing is not the greatest thing.
Yuck. Just yuck. It really, 20 years later, it's a bad look, as they would say.
The scene of them making out as they get into her apartment is so well done.
It's really good.
They've got such a height differential that sometimes he's picking her up, she's picking him up, they're spinning around, and it's like, yeah, it's a fun makeout.
Just watching that, I was like, wow, they worked really hard on this one scene without any jokes in it. It's just like they're getting from one room to the next, but they're doing all these very, like, careful movements and very well-animated movements.
Yeah, and, like, Jay's turn from the kiss to the bed and then going like, oh, boy, oh, boy.
Yeah, like so pounding his fist on the bed, so excited. So up next, this episode ends with just a weird epilogue. I think that's just there to kill time. And we learn how they really feel about the James Coco joke.
Hello, I'm Jay Sherman. Please don't give away the horrifying twist in this week's episode. Also, don't tell anyone about the James Coco chili joke. I'm pretty ashamed of that one myself. Thank you, and good night.
Jay, you can't end it like that. You gotta leave him with a laugh.
I don't feel like laughing. I think you bruised my kidney that time.
That's how it ends. And there was no twist in this episode.
No, well, I guess her being Humphrey is a twist.
Oh, yeah. I guess.
You know, it's a Crying Game again.
Yeah.
Yes, again.
There were even ads about, like, don't reveal the secret of the Crying Game.
Though that's just ripping off Alfred Hitchcock's ads for Psycho.
Well, yeah, of course it is. Although, as much as I did just say something nice about the animation, we did notice that when everyone gives Margot a talking to after she gives her big speech and she's sad – her hair is black for some reason.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can blame somebody in Korea for mispainting it.
Yeah, there's just one time it's like, wait, is it still Margot or is it someone else?
Oh, Lauren McMullen did nothing wrong.
It's like, remember in the previous episode, there's that brief flashback to when Eleanor is adopting Jay and her hair is red.
And also in Marty's first date, during his about to kiss Carmen scene, there's one scene where they're at night and then it goes back to like, no, it's not night, it's sunset. So that occasionally happens. And when you see that in the show, my understanding usually is like they did notice that, but they ran out of their retake budget. And they're like, They can only reanimate so many scenes in an episode. That's the classic Simpsons one. They told about how, like, an elephant was in one scene, but his tusks were also gray, and it was like the most expensive they ever had to do a retake. Is like, but he's in the shop for like a minute. And they're like, well, we just got to do it. And then meanwhile, in the Loch Ness episode, they couldn't undo it when they saw the Loch Ness monster come back pink on The Simpsons. They're like, this is terrible. This looks ridiculous. Like, well, what are you going to reanimate the last 4 minutes of that episode? I don't think we have the money for
that. A lot of money. But yeah, that was a good episode. I will say the third act, it kind of falls apart. I wish Margot, they did her more justice. She got to get more than a dance and her speech was better. But there was a lot of great stuff. I feel like Al Jean and Mike Reese, their one weakness is they're not confident enough when they should be. And I feel like the Jay and Barney stuff – or Humphrey, rather, was added just to be like, oh, this very emotional story about women, we need to, like, sex it up a bit, you know, or goof it up a bit. And I feel like I wish this was just about Margot. And Jay could play into it a lot more than just kind of dropping his story into there arbitrarily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that they write Jay as a sexless loser when he's had sex in three of the five episodes so far. Yeah. But I do really like this episode. My other gripe is, other than – a lame Crying Game bit, is that I feel like Eleanor should have learned a lesson too and have thought, like, I should never try to kill a horse again to make people do something.
Yeah, I mean, all she learned was like, oh, I got my way again. That's great.
I think I'm okay with Eleanor not learning lessons. I don't know. Somehow it's funnier to me if the characters who are cruel just are completely ignorant of the impact of their actions.
I mean, she did have to read I Love You off of a cue card earlier, so she didn't really learn a lesson there.
Her last scene is dancing with Franklin happily. I'm just like, I forgot what a good dancer you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of wish that, they even underlined, she didn't learn anything. This is how she does things. This is all part of the plan. She gets her way this way by threatening people if that's what it takes.
She's not a great person.
She's ruthless. She's absolutely ruthless.
Yes, and we'll see more of that as the episodes continue. But thank you so much for listening, everybody. I've been your host, Bob Mackey. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Retronauts. Every Monday, a new classic gaming topic and occasionally a bonus episode on Friday. I'm sure you've heard the show if you're giving us money on Patreon. But if you want to start listening, listen to our Simpsons-focused episodes. We've done one on Simpsons Arcade, one on Bart versus the Space Mutants and one on Bart's Nightmare, and we're sure to do more in the future. It's a great way to get into Retronauts, and just look for it on the internet at Retronauts.com or look for Retronauts in your podcast device. And Henry, what else can we tell them?
Well, yes, thank you to all you patrons who made this show a success, and be sure to tell all your friends about how cool it is that we do The Critic exclusively on Patreon, because we have all these other goals we want to hit, and we've got tons of other cool stuff that you should definitely be checking out on our Patreon. And yeah, and thank you again for your support. But I want to throw it now to our special guests.
And you can listen to me on 302010 every week. I'm on a podcast there that we look back on that particular week 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago in pop culture history. It's been a lot of fun. 1987 trailers are the best trailers in the world. And I'm also on Twitter now at LeCineNerd. Not listen a nerd.
You have to spell it, Diana.
LeCineNerd.
Excellent.
If you like video games, you can listen to my show about video games. It's called Video Game Apocalypse. We deliberately mispronounce video game because it's more fun that way. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at Wikiparas. AZ, not easy.
Excellent. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with Eyes on the Prize. Thanks for donating, and we'll see you then.
Excuse me, sir. The show's over.
But I have nowhere to go.